Wow, man, upticks in USDA's crop condition ratings for corn and soybeans have the grain and oilseed markets on the defensive this morning. At least there are some plus signs in the livestock trade. We are talking crop conditions, climate legislation, the ag economy, and another round of PPP from the Senate.
Live from the land of crops that just won't quit, via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Representative Austin Scott from the 8th District of Georgia. Then we chat with Jackson Takish. Boy, that was a tricky one, Chip. He's the chief economist and head of strategy and research from Farmer Mac. Then it's Paul Niefer, the farm CPA from Clifton, Larson, Allen. And right after the news, Margie Eckelkamp from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm Hanson Newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk.
Margie Eckelkamp.
Just take over from the scoop. Take over for me, please.
I am so glad that I can take no credit for writing any of that.
Joe, please start the show over. I want to redo.
Who's the guy who said he was so confident this morning? Who was feeling it?
I heard somebody.
That was me.
Somebody was talking about that just before we went on the air there, Big Apple.
And here's the thing. I should have known that. If there's one thing I've learned about myself, that when my confidence is sky high and I feel like I am inconceivably invincible, yes, I am quite vincible at that point. Vincible and whelming. Vincible and whelming.
That explains Chip's nervousness when...
Chip knows.
That's right. That's right. You can always count on it. Good stuff.
Well, we got a great show, everyone.
Davis,
I promise I won't say much.
Welcome.
From here on out.
Thank you. Not Margie. It's Annalisa.
Annalisa from Farm Journal's Milk. Yes.
Right. As a matter of fact, her name is really large on the phone screening system that we've got already set up and running. I don't know if you knew that we had such a thing.
I wrote this. I've been incorrect. I wrote this hours ago.
She's still on the line, too. She didn't hang up. Good for her.
I was so concerned about spelling Eckelkamp right that I didn't even realize it was not the correct name. It's all about the spelling this week, man. It's killing me.
Wow. Love it. And that chat with Jackson.
Chat with Jackson Takish. See, now I can say it.
Oh yeah, I am looking forward to all of the conversations today, because the conversation with Congressman Scott from Georgia, this goes back to a hearing that was held last week at the House Ag Committee. Congressman Scott is a member of the House Ag Committee on the pending climate legislation. They're having hearings trying to figure out exactly what should be done to combat the climate crisis. And some of the comments from Congressman Scott were so direct toward farmers need to understand what is going on. Otherwise, they could be asked to carry too much of the burden, to shoulder too much of the burden in getting to this net zero on carbon emissions by the year 2050. I wanted to get him on just to make sure that everybody's aware of the conversation that's being had. Okay.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Enough goofing around. Let's get to it. What you got in the news?
Well, let's see how this goes. Following are some highlights from USDA's crop progress and condition update for the week ending July 19, 2020. Chip, of note, the last time either corn or soybeans saw a 3-point jump at this point in the season was in 2001. Corn is 82% silking, 22% dough, 72% good to excellent. Soybeans, 76% blooming, 43% setting pods, 72% good to excellent. Spring wheat, 97% headed, 1% harvested, 70% good to excellent. Cotton, 84% squaring, 42% setting bolls, 49% good to excellent. And winter wheat is 81% harvested. Chip?
Yeah, the corn and soybean crops rated good to excellent at 72% is up 3 points from last week. So we went from being on the edge of, doggone it, it's going to be way too hot, it's going to be way too dry, to getting some very timely rains and these upticks in the national crop condition ratings. Does not mean that everything is well everywhere. I'm still focused on the western half of Iowa as a potential game changer in this crop.
Pro Farmer crop consultant Dr. Michael Cordonnier has raised his crop projections for both corn and soybeans. Cordonnier raised his corn yield forecast by a bushel and a half, but maintains a neutral bias going forward. Chip, that would put production at 14.99 billion bushels. Mm-hmm. Dr. Cordonnier added a full bushel to his U.S. soybean yield forecast, bringing total production up to 4.23 billion bushels on a yield forecast of 51 bushels per acre. Cordonnier said, quote, if the current beneficial weather continues into early August, the soybean estimate could move higher. Chip.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? At this point, that 14.99 billion and the 4.23 billion, I think those are kind of right in the middle of the ballpark kind of numbers. Okay. For what the trade is expecting.
Well, the Senate has released its version of the next round of COVID-19 aid to the tune of more than $1 trillion. The Health, Economic Assistance, Liability Protection, and Schools Act, it's easier just to say the HEALS Act, in part, extends unemployment benefits from $600 weekly to $200 weekly through the end of September. Chip, as far as ag provisions, the measure grants $20.457 billion to the Office of Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue to divvy up in a number of ways, including livestock producers who have had to euthanize market-ready animals. Yeah. The text of the bill reads quickly, the funds are, quote, to remain available until expended to prevent, prepare for, and respond to coronavirus by providing support to agricultural producers, growers, and processors. And Chip, as I understand it, that word processors in there also includes ethanol producers.
We're going to find out for sure. But yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And we're going to talk with Jackson Takish about the first round of CFAP payments. I mean, it was $16 billion to be rolled out to farmers. And I don't know if we're going to get there or not. You know what? Hey, buddy, we got to move on to Annalisa, okay?
Yep. You
bet. All right, Annalisa Laca, the editor of Farm Journal's Milk. How you doing, Annalisa?
I'm great, Chip. How are you?
Good, good, good. So these appropriations and the funding and the making sure that these programs can do everything that they can. How's the dairy supports doing?
Yeah, so the House Appropriations Bill, which passed earlier this week, there was some good news for dairy producers in there. $5 million of that bill is going to be used to help enforce standards of identity rules. And that's really what we're talking about when we're trying to fight terms like almond milk and soy milk. So the dairy industry was thrilled to see some support from Congress in that fight. There's also $6 million allocated for the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives program, and that program helps to provide grants to dairies to further, you know, like niche marketing and on-farm processing and those kind of things. And then, you know, the other thing that we've been talking about on and off over the spring is the need to help boost milk consumption among SNAP mm-hmm. recipients. And there's another $1 million directed to help pilot programs to do that. And then, of course, there's a few other things that, you know, dairy producers are interested in, just like all farmers will be. $10 million allocated for farm and ranch stress assistance, $990 million for rural broadband service, which is a 78% increase, actually.
Wow.
I was impressed by that number. Yeah. And so as we look to, you know, there's the likelihood that schools will have to virtual learn this year at some point. I think that's great news.
All right. Good stuff, Annalisa. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Chip.
You bet. You bet. That is Annalisa Laca, editor of Farm Journal's Milk. Some stress relief funding in there as well. Okay, coming back, we've got Representative Austin Scott from Georgia here on AgriTalk. No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
The best talkers in ag, including you. Join the conversation on AgriTalk. Call us at 855-4-TALK-AG.
Man, I tell you what a beautiful morning in Northeast Iowa, Davis.
Gorgeous, gorgeous.
This is really kind of an incredible day. Let me check. We are looking at 79 degrees right now.
Perfect.
Just incredible. Just incredible. Might get a shower overnight, but for the most part, it looks like it's going to be a beautiful week here, like I said, in Northeast Iowa. Even kind of a cool weekend. Highs in the mid-70s over the weekend, maybe? I don't know.
All right. Sounds like
I'll probably take it.
Sounds like campfire weather, hey?
Yeah, yeah. That's part of the reason that I think we've got bean prices off 12 to 15 cents here this morning. Corn's off a nickel.
The campfires?
No, the weather outlook.
That makes no sense, along with
the crop condition index or the crop condition ratings that we got from USDA yesterday, putting the markets under some pressure. All right, let's have a conversation right now with Representative Austin Scott. He is representing the 8th District of Georgia. He's a member of the House Ag Committee, member of the House Armed Services Committee, too, right, Congressman?
That's right.
Okay.
Well, I saw your Senator Joni Ernst yesterday. Great advocate for you out there.
Very good. Very good. Excellent. Welcome to AgriTalk, sir. Thank you so much for making time.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay. So the hearing last week on the climate crisis, some legislation being considered to get to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. So, like I said in the, at the open of the show, Congressman, some of your comments have been, I think, right on the mark as far as the industry, the ag industry. What do we need to understand about this goal, this potential legislation?
Well, the first thing that we need to understand is that the people that are driving the agenda on the left, the Environmental Defense Fund and others, they do not like production agriculture. If they had their way, everything would be small organic farms. And certainly we had a farmer from Georgia that was a part of the hearing, and he does farm that way. I would tell the American citizens that a small chicken he sells for $20.99 on his website, and four dozen eggs are $30. And so there's a certain segment of America that is extremely wealthy and is capable of paying those prices. But if you want to walk into a grocery store and buy a rotisserie chicken for $6, then you need to understand the end result of these environmental policies that they want to apply to the farm is the end of that. It's the end of that $6 chicken, rotisserie chicken at the grocery store.
Right. Congressman, one thing that I don't understand, and I'm sure that there is a reason that a lot of times the term organic and sustainability are combined and put together in one. I look at some of the organic product, and I've got nothing bad to say about organic producers. Okay. Let's get that straight.
Absolutely.
If consumers want organic foods for one reason or another, and these organic producers can fill that demand and make a premium for their product, good for them. That's awesome. But I don't see how organic and sustainability go together, and we need to find that sustainable source of an affordable, safe food supply going forward, not a $20 chicken.
That's absolutely right. And so the impact, you know, when they talk about this, they say, oh, well, it will only cost pennies more to produce. Well, if we're honest about what the farmer actually gets out of what we pay for the groceries, when we leave the store, the sales tax on our grocery bill is typically higher than the actual farm revenue from the products that we purchase at the grocery store. So they only want to get a little bit more of that. And if you increase the cost of operations on the farm, we're at a point, as you know, with corn just above $3 and cotton in the 60 cent range, we're looking at tremendous challenges throughout the ag economies and the rural America economies, because agriculture is where rural America's economy is founded. Yeah. And so you can't just keep putting things on the back of the farmer. Now, if there are things that make sense, then I can tell you farmers are good stewards of the environment, And if there are things that are cost effective, then that makes it a good business decision. And farmers will do that. And we want to see them doing those things. We just don't want it mandated from Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Congressman, I'll admit, one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the show to talk about the climate issues and some of these issues is because you seem to be keenly focused on the profitability of agriculture. And profitability is part of that sustainability word again. If you're not profitable, you're not sustainable. Where does that focus come from?
I'm just from the South. I mean, I'm from the farm. And so I recognize that if the bills don't get paid, then the tractor doesn't run in the field. And as you look at what's happening across the country, I mean, you're in the Corn Belt. I mean, 5 years ago, corn was almost twice what it is today.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 6 years ago, but there's only so much that you can squeeze out and still have American farmers planting the crops that feed the world. And so I think we're at a breaking point with that. My district's probably been hurt a little more than others because we lost so much capital when Hurricane Michael came through a few years ago. And then it took well over a year to get any type of disaster relief to our people. And so we've lost a tremendous amount of capital, not because we don't know how to grow the crops, but because of natural disasters. And then, you know, our production numbers have been good, but the markets that we're selling into are giving us a price that quite honestly, if we don't hit the yields that are close to record yields, then we're still upside down. And so there's no margin left. And while we've typically seen it across the country with a couple of commodity groups, it seems that it's every commodity group right now. And so I'm just very concerned that if we don't get some things done over the next few months, another round of MFP is something that I'm advocating for. Now let's be honest. Okay. MFP is not the long-term solution to the crisis that we have in farm income in this country. These are short-term solutions, but we have got to get the farm gate value of our products high enough that good farmers can make their bills if they're doing their job, and we're not there right now.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, when part of the issue there is that the COVID pandemic has exposed some of the vulnerabilities of the supply chain.
That's right.
And I know that you've got some great concerns over foreign ownership of the U.S. food supply. Address that.
That's right. So it's not just the foreign ownership. It's them injecting things into our food supply. Certainly, if you look at the federal agents have seized a tremendous amount of pork in the last couple of months coming into the country illegally. As you know, you've got African swine flu is out there in China and other parts of the world. And so we have to protect our food supply from those invasive diseases, invasive species, if you will. We've seen now where people are receiving packets of seed from China. They're unmarked. They didn't order them. Certainly, if you look at what the python has done to the Everglades and the destruction of that habitat, we have to be very careful in this country of what we bring into our country and the damage that it can do to our food supply. So that's an area where I do think that Americans are starting to pay more attention to the vulnerability of the food supply and the potential for whether it's disease or seeds coming in our habitat that create long-term destruction to our food supply. That's an area I don't think we talk enough about. I don't think we talk enough about China and Syngenta and effectively there's no other way to call it other than monopolization of the raw materials, the chemicals that we use, the seed that we use in ag production.
Right.
And so as we talk about it from pharmaceuticals, we need to make sure we're talking about it from ag production as well.
Yes. See, Congressman, you're talking about things that I think are going to be very important conversations. They should be had now, but if they're not had now, they're going to be had in the future, and they're going to be very important. That's why I've been keeping tabs on your comments, and we're going to continue to do that. I hope you'll come back and share some of your thoughts again in the future.
Hey, glad to. Y'all keep the faith. Thank you so much.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, I tell you, man, we get an uptick in the crop condition ratings and a big downtick in prices.
Yeah, that's definitely what's going on, Chip. You know, the 3-point increase in both corn and soybean ratings, good to excellent categories yesterday afternoon, really putting the markets under pressure. And just for some context there, these types of 3-point rises just don't happen in late July very often. It's only the third time ever for corn and a sixth time ever for soybean. So, you know, the combination of not as threatening conditions last week. Some of the dry areas got some rains, and that really made an improvement in the crop ratings and putting us under pressure there.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk more about what's going on in the corn market, soybean market, and what's going on with the crop conditions. And we'll get a download on what the plans are for the crop tour, the Pro Farmer Crop Tour, this afternoon on the show. We've got Brian coming on along with Jeff Wilson. Okay, take us over to the livestock trade. We've got feeder cattle kind of leading the way to the upside, huh?
Yeah, a lot of that's tied to the corn market for obvious reasons there. But, you know, just a very poor performance in the cattle market yesterday. And so it's good to see them bounce back this morning. We still have a lot of work to do to erase the damage that was done yesterday with the bearish reversals after the gap higher opens, but off to a positive start at least this morning.
Yeah, and disappointingly, we broke our string of days of export sales announcements for the grains, man. That was disappointing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's not helping the soybean market any. I mean, right, after 10 days, they'd become dependent on it. So now you take it away, and it's kind of like removing a drug from a drug user, and they're kind of in shock here this morning.
Thanks, Brian. We'll talk to you this afternoon.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. The truth is hard to come by these days unless you listen to AgriTalk.
You know, it was interesting that Congressman Scott mentioned Syngenta, and the reason that I say that is because AgriTalk, hashtag AgriTalk, was tagged in a comment from at AdamLash1 this morning on Twitter, wondering, good morning, Adam, should U.S. farmers continue doing business with Syngenta? That question was thrown out there by Adam.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
And it was interesting that that Congressman Scott brought that up and said, hey, you know, if we're going to be questioning the pharmaceutical side of things, should we be questioning the seed side of things? It's a conversation. I'm not saying that we shouldn't trust it. I'm not saying that. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you, it's a conversation that whether you want it to happen or not is probably going to happen in the weeks, months ahead.
Hey, and look, we're here to explore ideas, right? Isn't that what we're here to do?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, let's have a conversation right now with Jackson Takish. He is the chief economist and head of strategy, research, and analytics at Farmer Mac. Jackson, welcome back to AgriTalk. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, Chip. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you could come back because, boy, the... You want to talk about a unique situation and set of circumstances for the ag economy. We're right in the middle of one right now, aren't we?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you're talking about supply-side disruptions, demand-side disruptions. You got issues with labor. You got issues with capital. I mean, it's the whole spectrum of economic conditions are in flux somewhat today. And, you know, I'll say, fortunately, we've got some really good programs out there and USDA willing to step up and try to deliver some support to try to steady those things. But it's a lot for the agricultural producer and the lender to take in.
Yes, it certainly is. What's the health of the rural banking system? And the reason I'm going straight there, Jackson, is because back in the 1980s, yes, it was a farm crisis, but it really snowballed when it became a rural banking financial crisis. Do we still have a healthy banking system in rural America?
Yeah, I think we do, Chip. And a couple things I think that separate the current conditions from what we experienced in the 1980s, number one being interest rates. The very different interest rate picture, very different asset liability management picture today than we experienced 30 years ago, heck, 40 years ago now. So with very low interest rates, you can service more debt, you can stretch it out over longer periods of time for lower costs, and all that is very beneficial when you think about debt service coverage from both the borrower's perspective as well as the lender's perspective. And you know, the banks have more options now for capital than they did in the 1980s, and all that leads to more liquidity in the marketplace and lower stress on payments that the bank makes and payments that the farmers make.
You know, and farmers have alternative sources of funding available to them now. Not saying that they weren't available during the crisis in the 80s, but the alternative sources of funding available to them now, they're a bit of a different breed than what they were in the 80s. You might argue they're a touch more reliable.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the options, the ability to stretch out those payments for 34 years, even fix those interest payments, it's not something that many farmers had access to 40 years ago when we entered into that stressful period in farm banking. So I think having access to those longer products steadies the ship. Even when you see these interest rate movements, you have the ability to tap into the downside without experiencing the stress of the upside. And then you can focus on your business a little bit more. This is one of the things that Farmer Mac, you know, I work with Farmer Mac as chief economist. That's one of the things that we do. It's our mission is to provide that low cost, long-term capital out there to the marketplace.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jackson, the banking system's okay. We'll go with, and I agree. I think that's exactly right. But doesn't change the fact that some of the farms out there are looking at, they're looking at ending their operations because of financial difficulties, correct?
Yeah, it's you know, kind of one of those. How many years can you take of financial hardship? We're in year five of sort of a reset of the ag cycle, and that's a difficult situation to be in. So you do see a lot of even long term farming operations, you know, family farming operations, start to second guess and rethink their business model and what it is they need to do to get that business model right. And so it's certainly a hard time. You know, not only is it bad because of COVID-19 and all the economic disruptions associated with that, but it's just another year of lower commodity prices tacked on to 4 years of lower commodity prices. So you're kind of getting hit on a few angles here, and it's a tough situation for a lot of farmers out there.
Yeah, how are the rural communities dealing with COVID-19, dealing with the downturn in farm income? You got to have a thriving rural community out there to have a thriving ag industry.
Yeah, that's right. You know, originally when COVID-19 started to break, you had coronavirus circulating in the United States. There was a big gap between rural communities and more metro and urban communities. So it really spread quickly in places like New York, parts of California, cities in California, in the Washington, D.C. area. So you saw it really focused on the metro areas, but now it's sort of caught up in a lot of these rural areas. And, you know, you guys reported on this too, all the outbreaks at different farming, plants, food processing plants, as well as farms all across the country. So in the rural areas, the disease and the virus have really caught up in terms of case rates. Sort of expected that. You knew it was going to take a while for the virus to start to circulate in more rural areas, but it's there now, and there's really no difference. If you look at urban counties versus rural counties, there's really no statistical difference in terms of case rates. So this thing is circulating, and the disease is out there, even in rural areas. What I will say is it's easier to keep distance in certain rural communities, so businesses can probably stay open a little bit easier than some of the ones that are in the more metro areas.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But boy, the impact on the supply chain coming out of the middle of the country to the rest of the country, and specific, you know, out to the coast, the impact there has not gone unnoticed by consumers on both coasts, has it?
That's absolutely true. I mean, we saw a remarkable pivoting of the food supply chain mm-hmm. to be able to move out of restaurants and schools, change their packaging up, and try to sell into grocery stores and direct to consumer. It's just an incredible amount of work and logistical magic to make that happen. Yeah. And you're starting to see it. You're starting to see it pay off. I'm telling you, it's in the retail dollars that you see, the retail data that comes out of the census. We've seen a pretty solid move from the restaurants into grocery stores. It's not a one for one. So there's still a gap there. So restaurants, you know, people are not spending as much at the grocery store as they were on restaurants. But there's been a remarkable switch. And the supply chain to pivot like that has been really impressive to me.
You know I'm going to steal logistical magic and use it like it's my own, right?
You should. It's yours.
Because that's really good. That is a great way of defining it. So some of this transition from the restaurant food service back to retail, that's part of the recovery and part of what we need to see in this recovery. What else do we need to see? What's going to make you feel better about the ag economy going forward, Jackson?
Well, I think getting our global picture back into good shape. I mean, about one in every $5 of the farmer's take-home pay comes from a foreign market. So it's having a robust global trading system, having good partners out there who are buying goods, who are having growing economies, who are able to purchase the higher value goods, fruits, vegetables, nuts, as well as protein, animal protein. That's going to be a big part of the ag econ recovery for me. We're really good about growing things in this country, but we have to find places to put them. We're so good at growing it, we almost outgrow ourselves in the demand that we can have domestically. So getting that international demand up and running, that's going to be a key for 2021 and beyond to get this recovery in full swing.
Gotcha. CFAP funding, $16 billion for the ag economy. And I don't know if on the pace that we're on right now, Jackson, if USDA is going to find a way to spend all $16 billion of those dollars.
Yeah, it's going a little bit slower than I would have anticipated. And it's interesting to look at where the money is. They do a great job of reporting this on a weekly basis. Really centered in the cattle and calving communities, really centered in the dairy communities. Both of those industries need a lot of help with this disruption that we just talked about in the supply chain. That hit hard dairy prices as well as cattle prices. So it's good to see those producers taking advantage and able to get some dollars flowing through the programs. But the non-specialty crops, so you know, corn, soybeans, I think there's probably still some more dollars to go out there. And then the specialty crops, I haven't seen nearly as much uptake I would have thought in that sector. So nuts, fruits, vegetables, all those producers not really taking many dollars. I think that's where the gap is in the CFAP payments.
Okay, gotcha. Got about 30, 40 seconds left for you here. What do you want farmers in the farming community to know about Farmer Mac?
You know, we've been around for a little over 30 years, and our mission is to make sure that there is low-cost, long-term capital out there for farm real estate and for rural communities. And that's, we work with, you know, thousands of bankers, lenders all across the country to make sure that you got access to that long-term capital when you need it. And this is a time when I think we can all agree that we need it.
Yeah, there's no doubt that we, that source of reliable funding is very important to them out there. All right, Jackson, thank you so much for your time this morning. We sure appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Chip. Anytime.
You bet. That is Jackson Takish. He is the chief economist and head of strategy, research, and analytics at Farmer Mac. Okay. We talked about CFAP. We've talked about some of the government outlays coming into agriculture. We've talked about some COVID relief. New round coming our way. What's in it? What's it mean for you? We've got Paul Niefer coming up next.
You suffer from talking on the radio phobia? No problem. Send us a tweet at hashtag AgriTalk.
All right. Welcome back to AgriTalk. Glad that you could join us today. I'm your host, Chip. Got Davis with me.
Davis.
I'm here.
And we are joined now by the Farm CPA, Paul Nefer, Clifton Larson Allen. How you doing, Paul? It's good to talk with you again.
I'm doing good. I was telling you earlier, I'm in Colorado and getting ready to fly to Iowa to close on my farm that I just bought.
Excellent. Good work for you. Yeah. Okay. So let's start with the obvious question. There's another round of payroll protection program. And the obvious question is, are farmers eligible?
Yes, farmers are definitely eligible. Matter of fact, they have a special provision. It's Section 109 of the bill that the Senate put out. And it essentially says that if you were a sole proprietor farmer, a Schedule F farmer, and let's say you had a loss, and a lot of farmers have Schedule F losses because a lot of their income's on Form 4797, they weren't allowed to get any type of loan under the original PPP, but now this provision says we're going to allow you to use gross receipts, not net income. So if your sales were at least $100,000 as a Schedule F farmer, you're going to qualify for the maximum $20,833 loan amounts. So plus whatever employees you have, if any. So that was a pretty good deal. Now, the question I have in reading the verbiage of the law, I don't know. I don't think it applies to partners, but it might apply to partners. But this is a pretty good deal for farmers.
Okay. What does it mean to the farmer that might have, say, a half a dozen on payroll?
So what they would qualify for in that case, so let's say they originally applied for those employees and they had no net self-employment income, they're actually going to be able to go back to the PPP program and get an additional $20,833. Or if they didn't apply for it originally and they have some employees, they're going to get the $20,833 for them, for their earnings, plus all their employees are going to get 2.5 months of pay for that. And it should be fairly automatic according to, you know, to the actual bill. It says the lender should recalculate the loan and then advance the extra funds if the farmer qualifies.
Okay. One of the big questions about all this was, what kind of hoops do you have to jump through to make sure that these loans will be forgiven eventually, right?
What's the provisions there? That's really good news. If your loan amount is $150,000 or less, you don't have to provide any documentation to the bank at all. All you simply do is sign off on a one-page form that says you use the funds for whatever was required. You're supposed to retain those records, you know, those payroll records and other records for 3 years. Well, you have to do that for IRS tax purposes anyway, so this really is an extra burden. And the actual even better news, in my opinion, is for those a little bit larger farm operations. If they have a loan amount between $150,000 and $2 million, they don't have to provide any documentation to the bank. They do have to provide that, or they have to fill out that documentation, the worksheets. They have to maintain that internally, but they don't have to give it to the bank. So that's going to make it much easier for the bank to review this, sign off on it, and then push it on to the SBA to get that forgiveness.
I don't mean to be flippant about it, but that's kind of a rubber stamp kind of approval process at that point, isn't it?
It is. Now, it says that the SBA has the ability to go in and audit and do any type of testing to make sure that people are in compliance. But, you know, originally this program is designed, hey, we're just trying to pump money into the economy and as
stimulus.
Long as it's being used, we really don't care. Stimulus, exactly. Now, we know there's a fair amount of fraud, of course, in our state, state of Washington, on the unemployment side. I think it was about $5 billion that was defrauded. So, you know, we're always going to have that on any program like this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like we've talked about before. It's like the PPP has gone through two or three different definitions now. But, boy, the original intent of it was just to get money into the economy and keep people spending. Instead, it's turned into a business loan. It's turned into they marched that thing out in 10 days when it should have taken 10 months, Paul. So I'm not saying anything too bad about it. Okay.
Yeah. Now we have to give them credit. For, it's one of the few times where they've spent about $700 billion, like you say, with about 10 days of thought. So I do have to give them credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Little bit of time left. This is part of the HEALS Act from the Senate. Well, what else is in there that we need to know about?
Yeah, so on the HEALS side, there was this what was called an employee retention tax credit where you could get up to a $5,000 per employee credit, and this was refundable. So even though you didn't owe any tax, you actually got a check from Uncle Sam. Well, that's actually been bumped up to almost $20,000. And under the original CARES Act, you couldn't do it if you had a PPP loan. Well, now they're saying they're going to coordinate with the PPP loan, and you may qualify for this credit. So you're going to get the PPP loan forgiveness, and you potentially get this tax credit that's additional funds, but you can't double dip. So if you use the wages for PPP, you can't use it for the credit. But I think for a lot of farmers, they're going to find out that it's a pretty nice deal in that they should qualify for some additional payments from Uncle Sam beyond the PPP loan.
Okay. All right. HEALS, is it focused on on the livestock side of agriculture as we thought it might be?
I don't, it just says that, that you're going to get additional $20 billion. It's bringing in, ag processors, ethanol plants. So it's hard to tell.
Yeah. So in other words, it's going to be up to the discretion of the USDA Secretary Perdue's office.
Yep. And now, based on the HEALS Act, now we know the House wants to provide a little bit more guidance on what they want to have it to be used for.
Right. Right. Yeah. Much more targeted out of the House than it is out of the Senate. And, we got to keep in mind this might provide if HEALS is adopted, it could provide some flexibility for some support on 2020 crops. Paul, we're out of time. Thanks so much, buddy. We'll talk to you later.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chip.
That is Paul Niefer, Farm CPA, at Farm CPA on Twitter. You can also see his blogs on agweb.com. You got to come back this afternoon. We got Brian Grady and Jeff Wilson from Pro Farmer. And tomorrow morning, USDA former chief economist Joe Glauber and a farmer forum with Brad from Minnesota and Tim from Nebraska.